enlightenment. But first of all, the very word is not such a good word. It's one of those translations, just like the translation for samadhi being concentration, which is not that accurate and not that helpful. Now remember, in the history of Buddhism coming to Western countries, people that didn't really have much background, they tried their best to translate these words, you know, from ancient culture into English. They tried their very best, they did a very good job, but a few places it's a little bit misleading. And of course, one of the major ones there, as I've said from the beginning of this retreat, samadhi, the eighth factor of the Eightfold Path, does not mean concentration. Every time you see that, just say, no, that's not an accurate translation. Stillness is more accurate, and it's also more helpful to understand what this path is all about. Concentration is misleading and gets people very tense, and they miss what meditation is all about. Stillness is a good translation, so please, every time you see samadhi, remember it's stillness. And the same with enlightenment. It's not such a good translation. As I mentioned earlier, the word for Buddha means the awakened one. And that's a much better translation, to be awake. And hopefully you've actually found out during this retreat that sometimes you're more awake than others. And I'm not saying in the early morning. I'm saying about that sometimes during the day when everything is very bright and clear, your mind is very supple, you can do whatever you like to it, you want to sort of find out something, you can think very quickly and very accurately, you don't have to wander around all over the place with restless thought. That's what happens even in this world. You have a problem to fix or some project to complete, and sometimes you just can't think in a straight line. You start thinking, you go this way, that way, all over the way. You waste a lot of time and you don't really see what's really happening. So the idea of being awakened, having a very strong, very good mind, and it's also awakened to see all the silly things you do, the wrong ideas, the wrong views, to see all of that and to sort of extinguish it. Actually to see the truth, see what's actually really there, what's happening. And as I mentioned yesterday, or the day before, one of those days, you can't expect to awaken up and see the truth unless you have a very strong mind. And the whole purpose of meditation is giving you that strength to waken up, to be strongly mindful, and also to be able to let go of those two, what the Buddha called perversions of views, perceptions and thoughts of like wanting and not wanting. As I said, whatever you want to see, you tend to see. Whether you don't like seeing, you will block out. So being awake, it's not just having a strong mind, but it's also a strong mind which is free of all these biases of seeing what you want to see or not seeing what you don't want to see. And a good example of that, this idea came up this morning when we talked last night about psychic things or supernatural things. You know, for the last about 5 or 6 years, I thought we'd done away with this. People have been showing me photographs. And then these what they call Devalites on the photographs. These little sort of blobs of colour. And I remember when I first saw this, I was giving a retreat at Chaitawan Monastery. It wasn't Chaitawan. It was, what's the other place I used to go and give talks at in Petaling Jaya in Malaysia. I forget what it was. Chempaka Buddhist Lodge. In Chempaka Buddhist Lodge. When I went into the main hall, there was a big picture of this Tibetan monk who'd just been visiting with a big one of these orbs, his Devalites, just over his body and a donation box underneath. Come on, that's really gross. What he was saying without any words was, look, I have a Devalite, I must be a special monk, therefore there's a donation box. And that was really gross. And remember, I was trained in science. I really have to be very careful to make sure all these superstitions in Buddhism get discarded so you actually see what's really true. You just need to get on the internet if you're interested in these things. They usually call them orbs, O-R-B-S. And you find them in pubs, in nightclubs, probably in casinos too. And if they're heavenly beings, no heavenly being will be hanging out in a casino or in a bar. So straight away when I saw that, these can't be Devalites. So awaken up, what actually are they? And you just do science, all they are dust particles. Which on digital cameras, where the flashlight is to the front, the old cameras were towards the back, they can actually illuminate dust particles right in front of the lens, and it's a classic physics diffraction pattern. Nothing more than that. But, oh no. I saw that when I was in India on pilgrimage. These are Devalites. And it's amazing how many, the evidence is so strong there. It's obvious and it's science. But still, even many monks say, no, they are Devalites. And if there's this colour, that means that type of Deva. Another colour is another type of Deva. My goodness, even monks are gullible. So, why do they say that? It's because they want to see it. They want to see Devas. They want to have something to hold on to. Now that is the problem with getting enlightened or getting awakened. You really have to let go of all these wants and not wants. So you can see why this practice I've been teaching here over the last few days, not only is it getting you into deep meditation, but you're spending all these days, if you follow the instructions, of not wanting anything and not being averse to things. Open the door of your heart to the pain, the difficulties, the noise, whatever it is. So this path is not just to get you into jhanas. It's also to restrain and stop all this bending of reality to suit yourself. Letting go of the wanting and the aversion, not wanting to see what you don't like to see. When that is reduced, then you've got a good chance of seeing the truth, which is not what you want to see. It's not what you hate seeing, but what's actually there. And that is the job of what we call enlightenment, or rather awakening to the truth. So you can actually see this path of meditation. It's not just something which is optional, that you can somehow become enlightened or awakened without meditation. This is the core of it. So those people who come along and say, oh yeah, you can get enlightened without doing jhanas. I said, come on you guys, you haven't got a clue what you're talking about. How can you get awakened when you still have craving, when you still have wants and not wants, when you still have restlessness, when you're still dull, when you can't really see? Because otherwise you'll just see what you want to see, and that's all. And that's one of the problems, seeing what you want to see. Because, you know, you're all here, many of you have been meditating for such a long time, and even many monks have been meditating for many years. And you know, it's very embarrassing when someone comes up to you. Say, how long have you been a monk? 50 years. Are you enlightened yet? No. So number one, don't ask monks and nuns that question. They're trying their very best. Look at you guys. Some of you have been coming to retreats how many times? And have you got jhanas left yet? So give the monks and nuns a break, okay? You know, if you've done all this stuff, fine, you can criticize them. But sometimes it's very difficult. But as far as I'm concerned, as long as the monks and nuns are practicing, they're putting in the time, as long as you're putting in the time, I don't mind, great, it doesn't matter what you attain. At least you're doing the work and it's only a matter of time. So I always remember this story. It shows a little bit about what enlightenment's all about. Now, these two monks, and they were best of friends, and they were walking, you know, together, wandering around in the time of the Buddha. And it came to the time close to the range retreat, and that's the time when the monks and the nuns had to stay in one place. And there was this really lovely lady, a very devout Buddhist, who saw these monks and said, Venerable Sirs, please come and spend the range retreat close by to me. There's a beautiful little meadow next to the river. You know, you can wash there, you can do everything there, and I will cook for you every day. Whatever you want, whatever food you want, vegetarian, non-vegetarian, Singapore, Chinese, Penang, Western, Indian, Sri Lanka, whatever you want, I will cook for you. I will even, just so you can have all the time meditating, I will do the washing for you, I'll do everything for you. I just want to make the good karma of looking after two good monks for this 3 months and I'll do everything. And so those 2 monks accepted that. And this poor woman, a very devout Buddhist, she just worked her butt off for those monks, doing all the services. So the monks never needed to do anything, not even to give talks or instructions. They could meditate all day. And then a few years went by, and you know, everybody died. And when she died, she got reborn in the, Tawatingsa realm. And then she, because you know, she's a heavenly being now, she started wondering, what happened to those monks? I wonder where they are. And she found them in the Deva realm below her. Now she got one higher, and they were sort of underneath. And she was quite justifiably pissed off. So she went down to that Deva realm and scolded them. I worked so hard for you guys, and after all this, you know, I've got a better rebirth than you have. What were you doing those 3 months? Well, I was working for you, you lazy good-for-nothings. You know, I just did so much for you. I thought you were meditating. You're probably sleeping or chatting all day. I'm really upset with you. So it is, I say that, it is okay to scold monks. But not good ones, okay? And one of those monks, typical man, said, ah, it's just, you're a woman, go away. They do that, you know. So that's not a good monk. That's probably why he was down in that realm. The other one, he said, Mark Crikey, you're right. And he really took the scolding on board. And he remembered all of the teachings he'd been given. And because he's in a Deva body, you know, with all those teachings, he remembered them and immediately got a stage of enlightenment and went up to a much higher realm. He was a good monk. Number one, it shows you can get stages of enlightenment in the heaven realm. But also it shows you just sometimes, you know, it's really not who you are, what status you're in, but actually what you make with what you've got is really important. So with this awakening business, you really do need to get those deep states of meditation. It is an eightfold path. And hopefully you have also understood that why is it sometimes a meditation is really good, why is it sometimes difficult? The supporting conditions. Number one, obviously, is the right view. That's my job, to keep saying, let go. Don't struggle, don't strive. Don't try and attain things. This is letting go of things. It's not craving leads to suffering. Letting go leads to peace and stillness. The idea of the mist simile, so you know you're going downhill, you're getting more peaceful, more calm, more metta, great. My job is actually to brainwash you into right view. And that actually sets the scene, which means meditation can actually work. And that right intention, the second factor of the Eightfold Path, you know, that's one of the most neglected factors of the Eightfold Path. It is Nekama Sankapa, Vipada Sankapa, and Ahimsaka Sankapa. It literally means intentions, thoughts, inclinations of letting go. That's Nekama, renunciation. I don't say renounce your hair and become a nun. I'm saying let go of all your desires and cravings and your wants and your controlling. Kindness, metta is number two. This is the heart of the Eightfold Path. It's not some addition. It's not somehow, oh, I can do metta later, or I don't need to do metta. That's another type of meditation. I'm doing anapanasati. No, it is actually part of it. And you can't sort of ignore it. And the last one, Ahimsaka Sankapa, is literally gentleness, non-violence. And I'm amazed at how many meditators do violence to their body and their mind. You know, they sit here and they endure pain. And even though there are many empty chairs, they still sit on the floor. They ache here, they ache. It must be good for me sitting on the floor. I'm training. Real people get enlightened on the floor. No one gets enlightened on chairs. Did the Buddha sit on a chair under the Bodhi tree? No. You start with a chair, and then it's an armchair, and it's one of these chairs, like in business class, you can put your legs out and fall asleep. That's not the case. You have to be gentle with your body.
That is why I ask you all to sleep the first few days. That's just being kind of being gentle to your body. And my goodness, it works. So remember, this is the path to enlightenment. Right intention. Letting go. I call that just making peace. Because making peace is letting go of the will, which wants to change things. Making peace, being kind, being gentle. That's not the saying of Ajahn Brahm. That's the saying of the Buddha. Number two of the Eightfold Path. It's core teachings. And then you get the morality. Right speech, right action, right livelihood. So when you're quiet, you can't bring the wrong speech. As soon as you open your mouth, you're in trouble most of the time. So you're calm, you're quiet. You're actually not doing anything here. All you do is washing the dishes or cleaning. You can't really do much bad there. And livelihood, while you're here, you're not having a livelihood. Just on holiday. So those three are pretty easy to keep. But if you keep them in your lay life, you find your mind is very pure and very strong. And actually very happy too. That's one of the things people don't realize. Keeping precepts makes you happier. It's not just stopping you enjoying life. You actually enjoy life more. Give it a try. You have much more happiness when you keep precepts. And then you've got the right effort, which again, people don't have to look and see what it actually says. They think effort means yes, struggle. Come on, effort. One day left. Yes. I'm not going to sleep tonight. Enlightenment or bust. I'm really going to go for it. Last day, I've got to go back tomorrow. I've done nothing all week. I'm going to have to tell my friends who are going to ask me when I go back, what did you do? What did you get? I know Ajahn Brahm teaches jhanas. Did you get jhanas? When I went in last time, I got jhanas. Did you? So you say, I'm going to put right effort in. And you think right effort is sitting here, right, this is it. I'm not going to move. That is wrong effort. The Buddha actually said very clearly, whatever it takes to arouse wholesome qualities, peace, kindness, gentleness, to keep those wholesome qualities, to abandon all the negative qualities, anger, frustration, control, abandon those. What do you need to do for that? And you should know by now, every time you've striven, you've got hold of your body and said, right, this is it, I'm going to do something now. Have unwholesome qualities increased? Have wholesome qualities increased? Which one? And you'll find from experience, every time you struggle and strive, it's the unwholesome ones increase, the good ones decrease. You don't get peaceful. I have known many times people complain to me. They said, my husband went on retreat. When he came back, he was worse than ever. What type of retreat did he do? Not this retreat. He was striving, tough, control. It means wholesome qualities decrease. You're not so calm, you're not so peaceful. Whereas people on this retreat, they keep sending me letters. I think last year this lady came from Sydney and she sent me a letter back. And she said I had to beg my boss for 9 days off. I would actually just 1 week off. Beg him and grovel and promise all sorts of things. But he let me go. And when I came back, he said, what have you been taking on that retreat? Whatever drug it is, please bring me back some next time. Because he noticed she was much happier and more peaceful. And he thought it was some sort of illegal substance like cocaine or heroin or something. And it is. It is the jhana drug. You've heard of ecstasy, ice. This is a magic jhana drug. Only available in this. But it really works. So you can see it's wholesome qualities. It's the effort, as I said last night, is the effort to stop. The effort to go against the stream of craving, which is your habit. Every time you want something, you move towards it, you go and make it happen. You get it. And you never actually reach it, you just get suffering. But when you let go and stop, that is when these things happen. Which brings me to one of my favorite similes, another original Ajahn Brahm. I should actually stamp these ones and charge other monks who actually use this, charge them a, what do they call it, royalty fee. No, you don't do that. These are all free. You can use them as much as you like.
That's the simile of the donkey and the carrot. Once, oh, you know this, not once, but many, many years, they used to use donkeys to pull the carts. And in that car would be people travelling from one place to another, or there'd be the vegetables and other goods which they had to transport. So donkey carts were very common. But the trouble with a donkey, even though the donkey was very strong, donkeys are notoriously stubborn. So if you want that donkey to pull the cart, if the donkey doesn't want to, it won't. You can get a stick and beat that donkey, but the donkey still won't move. It doesn't respond to pain or punishment. What a donkey does respond to, though, is the carrot. So what the people did, they tied that stick to the back of the donkey's neck, not hitting him with it, until the front of the stick was about 2 feet in front of the donkey's head. On the end of the stick, they put a string. On the end of the string, a donkey. Now, sorry, and a donkey. Yeah. Maybe a really hot donkey of the opposite gender. Yeah, okay, you know. They put a carrot on the end of the string, not a donkey. So, if that was, say, a donkey in Indonesia or in Malaysia, they wouldn't put a carrot on there, they'd put a piece of durian. Because people like durian over there. So, this was a carrot on the end of that donkey. On the end of the string, on the donkey. So there you see the carrot. I better stop and just carry on before I make more mistakes. So there the donkey sees the carrot 2 foot in front of him. Now the donkey may be stubborn, but it's also stupid. So it sees the carrot there, so it moves towards the carrot. But because the carrot's on the end of the string, on the end of the stick, tied to the donkey, when the donkey moves, the carrot moves. The donkey runs, the carrot runs. So the carrot is always 2 feet in front of the donkey. It thinks it can get it. It's only you can see it right in front of you, just move a bit faster. But it never gets the carrot. And that's the way they get these donkeys to pull the cart. And they don't even have to waste the carrot. It's there at the end of the journey. Just like you. You've been chasing the carrot all your life. The perfect relationship. Sometimes you meet a boy and a girl. They're almost just right. Just a little bit more and you'll get them. And you move towards them, they move away. Move away, move away, move away. You never quite get it. Or the perfect job, or enough money. You almost got enough money, and then it moves away from you every time. Happiness, fulfillment, it's almost in your grasp. Even jhanas. You see the nimitta, you go for it, and it moves away. That's the story of people's life. Happiness, fulfillment, the object of your desires, is right in front of you, in touch, but you can't reach it. Whenever you go for it, it moves away. And that was the life of the donkey. Until the donkey learned Buddhism and read my book, Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond. Because in there it teaches the donkeys how to catch the carrot. And it's so obvious that the donkey had a bit of sense. So what the donkey does? The donkey runs like hell after the carrot, as fast as he can. He still can't catch the carrot. That's what the donkey has been doing for years. It may be running 30 miles an hour, the carrot is 30 miles an hour as well. But then, the donkey hears the Dhamma. Stop. And the donkey stops. And as soon as the donkey stops, the carrot goes further away. As soon as you let go and stop striving, and stop doing your meditation, it gets worse. You get restless, you get sleepy. I've got to put my effort in. No, wait, be patient. So the donkey sits there, and the carrot starts swinging away. And it goes 4 foot away from the donkey's head. Never been that far before. You think, oh, this meditation doesn't work. All this letting go, doing nothing business. My mind just gets restless, just gets tired. I better go back to Vipassana again. At least I feel good that I'm suffering. No!
wait, because it gets 4 foot away, and then something strange happens. Something which the donkey has never experienced ever in its life before. The carrot starts to come towards the donkey. Just like I said in Buddha Air. You sit down there, and all these things get served to you by the flight attendants. You don't even have to call them. They come to you. Or like sitting under the mango tree, you just open your hand and all these mangoes, they fall in. How they fall in, who knows, but they fall. 4 foot in front, and now it starts swinging towards the donkey. And the donkey looks, it's doing absolutely nothing, just staying there. And soon that carrot is 2 foot in front of the donkey's mouth, like it normally is. But this time, it's coming at great speed towards the monkey's, to the donkey's mouth. You know, all the donkey has to do is just be patient, just wait. And at the right moment, when it's, you know, it was there, it swung all the way out, back again. At the right moment, all it needs to do is remember metta. The door of my mouth is open to you, carrot. Without metta, it just bounces off the donkey's teeth. Opening the door of my mouth to you, carrot. Oh, thank you so much. That is how donkeys catch the carrots. Not by chasing after them, you've been doing that all your life. By stopping. And letting the thing go away from you and then come back to you and it goes right into your mouth. Now that is a very accurate simile for how enlightenment happens. You go chasing enlightenment and it'll always be away from you. Never get close to it. Maybe 2 foot at the most, but it will always be further from you. You won't be, you see it, you just can't get it. But following the donkey simile, you just stop. Do nothing. Sit down. Just be. Not going anywhere. Not chasing anything. Being content with your carrot going further away. And then after a little while, it starts coming towards you. And all you need to do is just sit there. Thank you. That is how meditation works. That is how enlightenment works. It's all about letting go. Not doing things. That is right effort. The effort to stop, to restrain, to say no. And it's a hard thing to do. The most difficult thing for people to do these days is nothing. You sometimes think, oh yeah, I'm going to go home and have a day off. Yeah, sure. Go and watch the movies on the TV. 36, 40 channels and still you've got nothing to watch. You go in the refrigerator, something to eat. It's packed, it's overflowing. You open the door and things fall out. No, nothing to eat. Can you just sit down and do nothing? So you listen to a talk by Ajahn Brahm. That's not doing nothing, that's doing something. Or you start thinking about the meaning of life. That's doing something. Listening to some music. That's doing something. Playing on a computer. That's doing something. I challenge you, 1 hour, go and sit by the stupa and do nothing. Can you do that? Of course you can't. You start worrying, how many minutes have I got to do now? You know, you start watching people, you start looking at the sunset, listening to the birds, fantasizing, thinking. It's so hard to do nothing and be still. The reason is because you've had that conditioned out of you. Ever since you were at school, I don't remember this, but I'm sure it happened. The teacher looked at me and said, what do you think about that? And I said, nothing. Stupid. I could have been enlightened much earlier. Those teachers at school. And sometimes I was lazy, just sitting around, hanging around, doing nothing. And my teacher and parents said, what are you doing? So I'm doing nothing. Oh, great, come and help me. People don't respect doing nothing. They go and disturb it. They think just because you're doing nothing, it means you're free. You're not free, you're busy. This is why one of my favourite Buddhist jokes. Yeah, I think I told this the last retreat, not this one. A person rang up the monastery. And they got hold of one of the monks. And said, can you please come to our house? We need some chanting. There's a ghost there or something. And the monk said, sorry, I'm busy. And the caller said, what are you doing? And the monk said, I'm doing nothing.
That's what monks are supposed to do, okay? So stop disturbing me. And the fellow was actually understood. He'd been to these retreats before, so he said, okay, fair enough, just carry on. And then he rang the monk the next day. Look, I really need you to come and do the chanting. The ghost has been there all night. And the monk said, I'm sorry, I'm busy. The man said, what are you doing? He said, I'm doing nothing. But that's what you were doing yesterday. Yes, said the monk, I'm not finished yet. And I like that joke. Not only it's funny, but it's also accurate. So, when you go home, you sit in your garden or sit in your room and do nothing, and when your wife or your husband says, can you come and give me a hand? You say, I'm busy. What are you doing? Nothing. And don't disrespect that. It doesn't mean that you can go and help. You say, no, I'm busy. I told you. I'm doing nothing. Ajahn Brahm told me, I've got to do that, okay? So you get out of the way. I'll come and help you when I finish. But you know what it's like. People don't understand. So I have all these other little tricks to get away with doing nothing. When people ask me, what are you doing? I say, I'm watching the trees grow. That's one of my favorite ones. So go out in the forest today and watch the trees grow. And that's all you're allowed to do. Nothing else. No thinking. No writing a book, no sort of having a cup of tea, just sitting down there watching a tree grow. Now you have to be very still. Trees, actually, they do grow, you know. So you have to be there a long time to watch it grow and be very patient. So it's just doing nothing. And that's such a difficult thing for people to do. And you know how difficult it is. You've got a nice lot of cushions, chairs, everything is really nice. You sit down. Can you sit down for half an hour and do nothing? Of course you can't. Instead of doing nothing, you meditate. That's not real meditation. Real meditation is sitting down, doing absolutely nothing. That's meditation. That's right effort. But no, I'm going to get jhanas. I'm going to get this. I'm going to do that. I'm going to think about this. I'm going to get my past lives. I'm going to... Oh, come on. You're here to let go. To be still. Not to attain things. That's why people don't get enlightened. They go chasing the carrot. They want to get meditation, they want to get jhanas, they're chasing things. They can only learn how just to do nothing and be still. My goodness, this meditation is so easy. If you can do nothing. You try to do things, you'll never get anywhere. You just get frustrated. You go round and round year after year after year after year. Looking for these things, never getting anything. That's why sometimes people get enlightened when they get frustrated and give up. There's so many stories of people who decided, I can't get enlightened, I'm giving up. I'm just going to sit here and kill time. So you sit here, I'm just going to do nothing. You stop chasing the carrot, and the carrot starts coming towards you. So many times that happened. Dania, is the workshop all locked up? The two of them? Because when I tell this story, I make sure that all the ropes are put safely away. Because there was a story of this nun. A bhikkhuni, 7 years she'd been in robes. And not once, not for a few seconds, has she had any peace in her meditation. It's wonderful when you hear that. You say, well, it's a bhikkhuni. I don't feel so bad now. I've only been here 9 days, I haven't had any peace. And this was a great nun who had 7 years of this. And after 7 years of trying, basically chasing the carrot, trying to meditate, trying, she had enough. She gave up. But she didn't want to disrobe, because in those days disrobing meant going back to your husband. You know, going back to the worldly life, cooking and all that sort of stuff. So she said, and this is actually how they used to say it in those days, she said she didn't want to go back to the three crooked things. This was an idiom in Pali, in the Buddhist language, 2500 years ago, the three crooked things for a housewife. The first crooked thing was the ladle, which went symbol of her cooking and housework. So she didn't want to go back to the ladle cooking this curry and that soup or whatever. So she didn't want to go back to the first crooked thing, the ladle. And the second crooked thing was the broom to sweep the house up. She didn't want to go back to the crooked thing of cleaning up the house. And the third crooked thing in this simile, you can read it yourself, it's absolutely accurate. The third crooked thing she didn't want to go back to was the husband. Those were the three crooked things in Buddhism in the time of the Buddha. So, you know, people did have a sense of humour, especially the women. So, think, all of those who are ordaining, you know, you've left the three crooked things. Yeah! The ladle, the broom, and the husband. The husbands aren't laughing. The wives know what I'm talking about. But anyway, so she did want to go back to the three crooked things. She couldn't stay as a nun because she was getting nowhere. So there's only one option. She took a length of rope, went into the forest, climbed a tree, tied one end of the rope to the tree and the other end around her neck. And she was just about to jump off. And she became enlightened. I'm sure that many nuns tried that. But she'd managed to do it so she could tell the story. Those other ones who didn't get there didn't tell any stories afterwards. But you think about that, what happened and why? And you know, she told this story in the Terigata, how she became enlightened. She'd been trying all her life and she wasn't going in the right direction. It was wrong effort. And then all she needed to do was just, well, give up, I'm letting go of this. Giving up, letting go, stopping trying, abandoning, renouncing. That is the key. So she was actually doing nothing for the first time in 7 years. And that's when it happened. She'd been chasing that carrot so hard that when she actually stopped, boom, boom, straight in the mouth. Now you can understand from this how meditation works and what enlightenment is. Enlightenment are stages of letting go. Just like the path, just like the goal. See how much you can let go. So, all these enlightenment experiences are not attainments. Not like you go to university and you get a degree. B.A. And you do another couple of years. M.A. And another few years. Ph.D. Another few years. Professor. Just like you don't say, Streaminer. And you get your certificate and I come up. I'm now going to give out the Streaminer certificates for this retreat. Please come up. You don't get certificates. You don't get anything. You lose things. So the more you lose, the emptier you are, the more still you are, the closer you are to enlightenment. So this whole idea of these things being attainments, things you can show off, I give you one medal for stream winning, two for once returner, three that shows that you're a non-returner, and the four you can wear those medals on your retreat. And the arahats, the fully enlightened, sit in the front. The next line is the non-returners, the once returners. And those scallywags who've got nothing at all have to sit on the back. You don't do that. And have you ever looked at any monastery, any group of monks and nuns? You don't know who is the arahat, who is the one who's a non-returner. You don't know who's the scallywag. Well, sometimes you know who that one is. You just have to look and see how they behave. But you don't really know, because there's a reason why we don't let people know and why we don't show off, because it's not the sort of thing you do show off. It's the sort of thing which is just unshow-offable. It's just disappearing, it empties, nothing there. That's what this awakening is. Awakening to emptiness. Already mentioned Anatta, there's nobody in here, so who the hell is enlightened? Who the hell is a stream winner? There's no one in there. So actually we don't really say, people understand what they're talking about, we don't say, oh, he's an arahat, she's a once returner. We don't say these things.
You just say, oh, all these things have disappeared. You say, he's a loser. She's a big loser. He is the biggest loser. They're more and more empty. That's what enlightenment is. So sometimes people get afraid. Say, look, I want to be. Please let me be. If you want to be, you're going to suffer. The more you disappear, the less of a target you are for the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, which Hamlet said. No, when you disappear, you're free. There's no one there. People call you a pig. Who did you say was a pig? I don't know who's a pig. Did I? I think I told that joke at the first about the Anicca Dukkha Anatta walk into a bar. Because I told you that Buddhism is actually getting strong in a place like Australia. So in the West, we're getting jokes, real Western jokes on Buddhist principles. So, you know, there's many jokes. If those of you who like Western jokes always say, you know, a priest, a rabbi and a monk walked into a pub or into a bar. There's always something walks into a bar. That's classic start of a joke. So someone said, I think that Ajahn Sujatha got this one, so you can blame him. Anicca Dukkha Anatta walked into a bar. Now, Anicca means impermanence. Dukkha is suffering. Anatta, no self. So, impermanence, suffering and no self walk into a bar. Suffering says, this bar sucks, it's terrible, it's awful. Because it's dukkha. Anicca said, don't worry, it will change. And Anatta, no self, said, who said that? Who said that? That's a Buddhist joke. I thought it was very funny. Very clever. You guys are hopeless. I don't care. I'm just going to laugh at my jokes. I don't care if anyone laughs at all. I think it's funny and that's enough. So this is actually what happens with enlightenment. So how does enlightenment happen? And what is it when it does happen? So I've already mentioned how it happens. You've just got to really let go. You let go and you become incredibly still. No likes, no dislikes. All of that is suppressed by not wanting, not striving, not struggling. You get very clear, very strong. Mentioning you get into these amazing jhanas which gives you the data, stuff which you never expected could exist. You mean you can vanish? Your body can disappear? Your will can actually stop so it's not there anymore? Or your mind can start vanishing? All these things you thought were you are gone? That is scary. But it's true. You come out after and say, gee, that couldn't have been me after all. And all these things you thought you were, you realize you're not. And again, head over heels, all that stupid stuff you thought is not true anymore. So people can call you whatever they like. They can call you, you are the fattest monk in the whole of the whole Sangha. I've never seen a monk as fat as you, Ajahn Brahm. I say, who's fat? I'm not fat. My body's fat, but not my mind. So you don't worry about it. There's no one there. It's just five khandhas are fat. It's just five khandhas. There's the five elements doing what they're supposed to do. Nothing to do with me. Not my problem. Someone said that was a very bad joke you just told. Who told it? I didn't tell it. Nothing to do with me. The doctor says, Ajahn Brahm, you're so fat, you've got diabetes, cholesterol, stroke, you're going to die this evening because of, you know, all that bad stuff going through. He said, who's going to die? Not me. I don't know. I'm not scared. This is where you find out if you really understand there's nobody in there. When you're about to die. I must say that sometimes you want to find out who's enlightened and who's not. So if you want to find out when they get really sick, that's always a good time. There's that Sri Lankan monk who lived in Kuala Lumpur, Kesari Dharmananda. You've got to give credit where credit's due. When he was told by his doctor, his doctor told me this. He said, when I told him his cancer was terminal
There was no cure, no possibility of any treatment. He's going to die. This monk burst out laughing. He laughed. And the doctor, I've never ever seen anyone do that. Now that's a good monk. So, challenge you. When you get your biopsy back, and they say, you've got breast cancer, it's malignant, you're going to die. Can you laugh? Who's dying anyway? You've done it before so many times. So what's the big deal? You're just dying, that's all. Just a body going. It's going to go anyway. And if you die young, it's amazing, it's wonderful. You don't have to have all this problem with old age problems, you know, there's dementia, old people's homes. Have you seen these old people's homes? They're pretty good at the moment, but they're getting so full. Can your children actually afford that? Times are tough after the GFC. So many of your children say, I'm sorry, Mum, we can't afford the best, so you're going to have to do with the economy, old people's home. And that's you have to endure that. Is that a nice thing to look forward to? So if you're only 23 and the doctor says you've got breast cancer, you're going to die. Yes! I've escaped from the old people's home. Woohoo! Then I say, okay, you know, you've understood. So that's when you really find out whether you've let go. When you get challenged. There's this one old fellow. Do you remember, some of you have been here a long time, the fellow called Patrick, he had the Harley Davidson. Very early on. One of the first people, he was one of the first people who stayed at Bodhin Yana Monastery. And he was one of these guys. You know, an Australian, he would just, had no real attachments, you know, no wife, no partner, no house. He just had this incredibly beautiful Harley Davidson motorbike. And he would just travel around, stay at sort of monasteries or religious centres, because they always give him a place to stay at night and food, and he'd just do some work. You know, like a temple hopper, having a really nice life. You know, no ties at all. Whenever he felt that he wanted to go somewhere, he'd get on his bike and go to the other end of Australia. And he spent about 6 months, maybe 9 months, staying with us. And he kept in contact. And he said he was in Sydney, staying at some temple. He parked his Harley in one of these shopping mall car parks, went to do a little bit of shopping. And after doing the shopping, went to the car park to pick up his Harley and go home. And he found his Harley had been stolen. The car parking bay was empty. It's not that hard to steal a bike. You know, just, you've got a truck, lift it up, put it on. And that was the only thing he owned. And it was actually worth a lot of money. Some of these Harleys are $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 or more. Really expensive. The one thing which he owned, and the one thing which gave him freedom to go wherever he wanted, whenever he wanted. Some idiot has stolen it, probably to pay for drugs or whatever, in Sydney. And straight away, he let it go. Oh well, you know, these things, they come, they go, so what, big deal. And he said, I hope whoever's stolen it has a happy time on my bike, as happy a time as I have had. He was very proud of himself. The one thing, the only thing which he owned, he could let it go that easy. And then, after thinking, wow, this actually, Buddhism actually works, he can let go. And then he realized he was on the wrong level of the car park. He went down to the correct level, his Harley was there. And he wrote to me and said, great, what a wonderful test. I actually passed and I still got my Harley. That shows how enlightened you are, how close you are, how easy you can let go of the things you attach to the most. So enlightenment is not being able to say, oh, I can explain it. I can give a talk on dependent origination for 2 hours, really see all the connections. That's intellectual stuff. It's whether it works in your daily life, whether you really can let go and not be such a control freak in life. Being a control freak is asking from life what it will never give you, what it can't give you. That's the wisdom. You know, people steal things. That's the nature of life. So sooner or later they're going to steal something of yours. You can't stop that. You can try and prevent it as much as you like. But when it happens, you say, oh well, there we go, that's the nature of life. Things get stolen. People get sick. That's the nature of life. We get sick from time to time. People die any time. That's the nature of life. You don't ask from life what it can never give you. Husbands, they let you down. That's the nature of husbands. Don't ask from a husband what he'll never be able to give you. Before you get married, read the contract, the fine print, what a husband is like. So once you get married, stop complaining. That was in the contract. If you're a guy and you get married, read the contract, what women are like. Ask all your friends. Don't think that your one is different. Don't ask from a partner something they'll never be able to give you. When you become a bhikkhuni, when you ordain, read the contract, you nuns. Don't ask for monastic life what it'll never be able to give you. So when you do things like that, you're becoming wise, which means you don't complain anymore. No greed, no ill will. You accept life and death and sickness and heat and cold and pain and bad jokes. You should know that by now. You know my reputation. So when you come to an Ajahn Brahm retreat, you know you're going to hear those old jokes again and again and again. It's part of the contract. So don't ask for me what I can never give you. Now you're understanding what this enlightenment business is. You let go. And four stages of enlightenment. I'm going to be quick because I've only got 3 minutes left to go to the four stages. First, you see there's nobody in there. You see that? Oh, what a great relief. There's no one in there. It's just an empty process. This thing which you thought you were. You know, your body, if you're young and beautiful and handsome, you think, oh, I'm beautiful. You're not. It's just a temporary anomaly, that's all. Soon you're going to get ugly and old like everybody else. So you better get used to it now. Number two. You know, you're not your wisdom. And I used to be really sharp. You know, I got a big degree from Cambridge. I forgot all of it now. All that hard work studying. And remembering all that stuff, and it's all gone now. What a waste of time. So you, like everybody else, are going to lose it. You're going to forget who's who. I've got big trouble now. I'm 61. And so many people, they come up to me and say, do you remember me? I saw you in Indonesia in 2002. Oh, give me a break. But I have to be honest. I started saying, no, of course I don't remember you. And that really upset people. So these days I changed it. I've got this trick now. When people say, do you remember me? I say, oh yeah, you're that person whose name I keep forgetting. That's a good trick. What was your name again? So you're going to get up. So I've got another 3 stages of enlightenment to go yet. The first one is you totally let go of your sense of identity. You can be whoever you like. That's why you can know that. People scold you. They call you an idiot. They call you, Ajahn Brahm, you're dressed like a girl. You know, you shouldn't go in the male toilets. Go in the female toilets. That's what you look like. And you can laugh with them because you don't take it personal. There's no person in there to get offended. So you see there's no self in there. The simile, which is the best from the Buddha, is a simile of the shipwrecked sailors. So it's actually seven, I forget the first three. The fourth shipwrecked sailor is floating in the ocean and he looks around. The reason he floats is because they say it's got good precepts. If you've got bad precepts, you see. You don't stay up long enough to see what's going on. So this shipwrecked sailor, he's very, very, very good, good virtue, and also he looks around and he sees the shore. There's dry land over there. That's called the stream winner. You see the shore, you see safety from all this suffering. You see non-self. There's no one in there.
And then
the fifth shipwrecked sailor starts swimming towards the shore. They call that the once returner, the next stage of enlightenment. The next stage of enlightenment is not something which you can really say, now I am, now I'm not. That's not like an experience. It's just a strengthening of your wisdom. The first one is an experience. The first time you see there's nobody in there, that really shocks you. So you're swimming towards the shore, and you get close enough towards the shore that you can actually stand up. You're still in the water, maybe up to your waist or up to your knees. You're still in the water, but you can actually stand and start wading to the dry land. That's the non-returner. They've let go so much. All attachment to the five senses they've let go of. No more lust. No more anger or ill will. And that's actually how you can tell if someone's at that stage. Try and make them angry. We do that on purpose. This is my job. If someone comes up, a monk comes up to me, or a nun comes up to me, if a nale comes up to me and says, Ajahn Brahm, such a great retreat, I'm now a non-returner. And I go up and say, you? You're a girl. Girls can't become enlightened. See if I can get them angry. So, you know, you're too young to get enlightened. You're stupid. No way can you become enlightened. Whatever I do to try and offend them. And if she sits and says, oh yeah, fine. Maybe it's true. But she said, what are you saying that girls can't become enlightened? That is sexist, Ajahn Brahm. If they get angry, say, okay, I've tested you out. You failed. You're not a non-returner. Non-returners don't get angry. So you try and upset them and see what happens. But please don't try that on me. Please don't not be me my breakfast tomorrow morning, Rodney. See, I'm going to test him out, see if he really is enlightened or not. Try and make me angry. That's what we do. Enlightened people don't get angry. Or non-returners. And that's, you're wading to the shore, and when you reach the shore, totally free of all attachments, all defilements, all craving, then you're fully enlightened. Or fully awakened. This is just the nature of things. It's just an empty process. No need to get reborn again. You only get reborn because you think there's something to be reborn. You want to be reborn. What to be reborn again for? Haven't you had enough? And some people say, no, I haven't had enough. I want to come back again to see the latest remake of Harry Potter. I want to see the next episode of Big Brother or whatever else people get attached to. Amazing what people actually want to do, why they want to keep coming back. But once you've had enough, no desires, you've had enough, and that's the end of things. That's the fully enlightened being. So that's the four stages of enlightenment. I didn't go into great detail of what they are. I spent more time in how it happens. And putting together this whole path of meditation, letting go, making peace, being kind, bringing up the Eightfold Path. And this is actually what happens. It's all about letting go, disappearing, not attaining, not striving, but just sitting still, carrot comes towards you. It's what enlightenment is, no desire, end of craving, making peace, being still. That's what enlightenment is. At least it gives you a taste. So, there we go. That's the talk for this morning. Now I've given you the talk. Now it's up to you. Please don't do it. I charge you today with spending the rest of the day doing nothing. Or rather, nothing doing.